Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Dealmakers.
Hello, everybody out there in Buckhead Business Radio X land. My name is Trace Crow, and for the next hour, me and my merry band of business people will be taking over the airwaves at BBRX to host this session of the Atlanta Dealmakers Ritz Group Radio Show. Now, the Ritz Group is a Buckhead-based networking organization that connects entrepreneurs with investors. Specifically, we take companies that are looking for first-round or seed-round funding but don't know where to turn for help. Whether it's making connections with investors or working on their pitch deck, we help good, fundable companies fill the gaps in their business to make them a more attractive target for investors. Then we turn around and provide them as many opportunities as we can to get in front of those very investors. Now, we meet every month at the City Club in Buckhead for our monthly networking meeting, and the tentpole event of our meetings is our Shark Attack, which is a live and local version of Shark Tank, where we take three of the best entrepreneurs in the Ritz Group and pit them against three Georgia investment icons. The networking meeting and Shark Attack are just a few of the multitude of ways we feature our members. We also have Twitter, guest blog spots, a video presentation at our monthly meetings, tons of updated content in our private online community, and featuring spots on our weekly email blast that goes out to 2,500 people every week. We believe in Georgia's entrepreneurs, and so we find as many ways as possible to help them build customers, hone their business model, craft their pitch, and find investment. Of course, if you'd like more information about the Ritz Group, you can simply go to our website at www.ritzgroup.org. Now, I am joined today by four spectacular people who are all working at some level to make the Ritz Group one of the best entrepreneurial organizations in the Southeast. We have the always entertaining Michael Moore, rainmaker and chief storyteller. We've got Angie Sandritter from Cygnus Strategy Group, Kat Phillips from Cat Scratch Films, and of course, Larry White, the owner of the Ritz Group. We're going to learn about all of each of them and what they're going to do for the Ritz Group. But first, I'm going to be just a tad selfish and take a moment to introduce myself and explain why exactly I'm even here on the radio right now. As I said, my name is Trace Crow, and I'm what is called an ambassador for the Ritz Group, which is really just a fancy way of saying that I'm an official super fan of the organization. I help manage the growing membership. I make sure our members are taking advantage of all the amazing things we offer and help the owner, Larry White, come up with even better ways to help our companies get funded. Now, a little history. I received my MBA from the great University of West Georgia last summer, and before that, I received a BA in history of all things from the University of Michigan. Between those two degrees, I released two rock albums with two different bands, moved from Michigan to Tennessee, then to Georgia, worked in financial sales for 6 years, wrote two novels, one screenplay, and countless short stories, all while getting married and helping raise two kids. After doing, obviously, a whole lot of different things, I decided to go back to business school at West Georgia because I wanted to make a difference in the world, no matter how small, and I felt that business was an excellent way to positively influence the lives of others in a more direct way. Last fall, I met Larry. He was fortuitously speaking at an event, and I knew that the Ritz Group was doing something really important in Atlanta, and I knew I'd found my place and wanted to be a part of it. So, all right, enough about me. Let's get to it. First up, we have Mr. Michael Moore. Now, he brings over 40 years of leadership, analytical, and operational skills to the game. Michael grew up as a farm kid with a desire to make things work better and work faster. Now, this trait related quickly to scouting and adolescent leadership successes prior to collegiate success. Michael has occupied leadership formational and operational positions in medical, technology, and the service industries. He has been a founding partner and functional leader in several startups and growing companies. And Michael is, above all, a consummate connector and net weaver for groups and organizations in the Atlanta region as well as nationally. Mr. Moore, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you.
All
as
right.
As always, we're looking to have a lot of fun today.
Yes, absolutely. So how did you become involved with the Ritz Group?
Well, that goes back to that time back around, we all remember it was 9/11. Right after that, Mr. White and I started looking at how we might revive the Georgia marketplace. We were sitting over in a place called the Resource Forum, which is right over in Tower Place, enjoying our then co-working space, thinking, as you said earlier, ways to improve the process here in Georgia. And we started looking at ways to educate entrepreneurs as we came out of a fairly dim time in our past, as well as give people information which they were not going to find in books yet because it wasn't published.
All right. All right. And so tell me, I touched a little bit on your background. Tell me about a little bit about your background that led you to that the Resource Center post 9/11 with Mr. White.
Well, I've been an entrepreneur since about age 8 when I convinced my brother, then older brother, to we should get 3 paper routes between us because he had the car and there wasn't enough money in one. So between 2 of us, we could have 3 routes. So I became an entrepreneur then, I guess, by convincing as well as delivering service to our customers. In high school and college, I found ways to be involved with businesses from selling cars to running bars and other things. Consummated that college degree with something I couldn't do for a living the rest of my life, which was become a military officer during an unpopular war. Picked up a wife like you along the way, picked up children along the way, and realized that being a banker wasn't the way I was going to retire, that I should probably be an entrepreneur. So I went back to something I knew and enjoyed quite well. I've been selling and carrying a bag for a lot of people, helping people learn things they might need to know to be successful tomorrow as opposed to be just what they're doing today.
All right, excellent. Now, you're not just involved with the Ritz Group. You're also involved with Club E down in College Park. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, what you're doing for them?
Yeah, one of my daytime activities, as my wife says, is to go out and work with young entrepreneurs also that, and we have a new name for them, and it's not new, but something we use all the time. It's called wannapreneurs. People really want to be entrepreneurs, but they have no idea what steps it takes to get there. It just doesn't mean taking out your credit card and spending to the limit and hoping your business works on some wild cockamamie scheme. It does mean taking a market niche, as some people say, and planning for some successes in it, learning what might be appropriate, finding some products, getting some people on your team that are smarter than you are, and looking for a way to make that happen. And most often that means doing something you're unaccustomed to. To do that, you probably need some new knowledge because the knowledge that got you to whatever idea point you were is not going to make a successful business normally. So we take people that are everything from postal workers to retiring FAA employees to homeless people, literally, recovering addicts, moms who have been fired recently, and we help give them the skill sets they need. Club E is an entrepreneurial club down in the south side of the city, not necessarily considered to be a co-working space, but we're actually a community of entrepreneurs and wannabe-preneurs that are looking for ways to help each other and participate. So that's my daily activity. I'm the executive resident there for a very generous man who put about $1 million into an old building in a place where most people think is not so popular called College Park.
Well, that's excellent. That's excellent. So you kind of touched on this, but what are some of the biggest challenges for startup businesses, not just young entrepreneurs or wannapreneurs, but anyone who's starting a business?
I think I'll put that down into three categories. One is to have a viable and workable idea. Two is to build a team that can help deliver that idea. And three is to find a way to fund that resource, fund that idea while it becomes successful. Whatever those things can be done, most people can't get those three legs of the stool together.
All right. And that's kind of, and the last one is really where the Ritz Group kind of comes in. We help people get themselves so that they can be fundable, so help them fill the gaps and then get them in front of investors. Since you've been involved with the Ritz Group, which is over 10 years now, what have been the results of your involvement with the Ritz Group?
Wow. Well, most people that have gone down to our website, if the channels are active out there, and they've gone back to see the Ritz Group has had a 20-plus year history here in Georgia with the original founders. But we've tried to connect people who are of the two resources, one the needs and two of the haves. A business entrepreneur doesn't always know where to find the monies, and of course we all know they're not bankable. You hit on the term very well. We need to make them investor ready, and that means to position themselves where they have the right answers to the questions the investor has to feel comfortable, because it all works around the trust of the investor versus the reality of the business. If it's believable as well as doable, then there's an investor out there somewhere and the sound of our voice that will help fund that business.
Excellent. What would you recommend to those who have not been to the Ritz Group yet or who are seeking help, you know, help in from the funding perspective, from perspective of just getting their business plan together and their business model together?
I'll use that word like they use in real estate about location, location, location. Let's just change it to simplify, simplify, simplify. Because most people make their idea way too complex for the average investor to understand. They get too engrossed and involved with their ideas and how they could paint stripes on something that only needs to be a solid color. And that's probably the major thing. They get too complicated too quickly.
All right, excellent. And of course, I'll add in there, you've got the Ritz Group that can help you with any of your funding needs. If you're an entrepreneur and if you're an investor, you can pop on in and take a look at what kind of businesses that we have. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Moore.
My pleasure.
And we'll be talking to you a little bit later on in the show about the investment ecosystem here in the state of Georgia. Now, next up, we have Angie Sandritter from Cygnus Strategy Group. Angie is a motivated, organized executive. She's a self-starter with 15-plus years of telecommunications or high-tech industry experience. She drives towards successfully achieves a high rate of revenue growth and customer satisfaction with a background in IT. She's able to understand technology and assign business value and positioning to technical concepts. She's also a holder of a master's in business administration, has achieved the CCNP and CCNA certifications. She participates actively in regional economic development organizations and steering committees. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Trace.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about yourself and your background. Again, I touched on it a little bit here, but give us some of your background, some of that 15-plus years you have, and then tell us about what led to starting Cygnus Strategy.
So, good question. I started out from school working in a telecom company and having the opportunity to hear customers and their experiences in telecom as they begin to grow. And a lot of times people think of telecom as running cable between buildings and making sure that you can pick up your handset and make phone calls. But as we discuss this, you'll see that it is evolving into a much broader field as mobile developments are arising and so forth. So I've always found that evolving technology to be very exciting. What I enjoyed coming from a technical standpoint and an engineering background, being able to later go get my MBA and assign business value to these concepts. Michael touched on it well earlier. A lot of times you create a gadget, you create an app, you create a new concept as an entrepreneur, as a startup, and you think this is wonderful because it's technologically advanced, but it has no business value. So I like to assign the business value to this particular concept and say, where's the addressable market? Do you have the right price point? Is there a displacement technology or another technology that can do the same thing cheaper? And why would I go with you? And being able to hone in on that. And that evolved into Cygnus Strategy Group. So I'm one of the partners there. That's the role I play in this particular company. But it is a multidiscipline strategy group, which looks at everything from HR to legal to change management to mergers and acquisitions. We have a series of partners and subject matter experts that provide that type of expertise to entrepreneurs and small businesses alike. So we look at the whole company and we determine, are you in your element? Meaning, are you in the right spot within your company? Is everybody working together to achieve the ultimate goal that you have in mind? So that's where Cygnus Strategy Groups comes into play and a little bit about my background.
All right. And you you guys are based out of Huntsville now, but that's not the way it's always going to be, right? You've got your eyes on Atlanta. What are you doing to move into the Atlanta market?
That's a great question. So we are setting up an office here, and we're establishing client base in Atlanta. We've been here for roughly 6 months or so getting started, and one of the first places we're plugging in is with the Ritz Group. So we're excited to be partnering with the Ritz Group in this capacity.
Yeah, excellent. Now, the story of how we met, you got plugged in with the Ritz Group is maybe not the most appropriate to put on the air, but it was definitely, we'll just say it was like from a movie. It was entertaining. It was a nice little meet cute to bring Kat in here with the movies. It was very fortuitous. We literally just bumped into each other, your husband Timo, it's been wonderful so far. So what sort of way will you be involved with the Ritz Group going forward?
So I'm excited to participate with the IGL role that I know you'll be talking about in a moment, Trace. But with the background in telecom, I'm excited to be an industry group leader and be able to match entrepreneurs with funding and be able to talk about what's going on in this particular space.
All right, excellent. Now, why is telecom important today for entrepreneurs?
And again, I go back to everybody probably remembers the switchboard illustrations where you picture you're actually switching calls, and telecom might have that perception in a lot of people's mind. But if you're following what's going on today, it's very, very exciting with the evolution of cloud technology and how that's taking off from Amazon Cloud to all different types of venues to obviously the boom in mobile technology. So everybody is communicating today via their mobile devices. And then even taking that on to how can we communicate or even put our phone system in the web. So it goes beyond the traditional type of minute charging that we may have been accustomed to with long distance in the past and running cables or copper wires in between buildings to make phone calls. There's a whole exciting type of evolution going on in communications today. And this allows entrepreneurs to come up with tools that can help businesses be more competitive, can sharpen their processes by having an application or a way to communicate that would make their business more effective.
All right. And what are the prospects here in Atlanta? Is there a lot of support? Is there a lot of infrastructure that would makes this a good place for telecom entrepreneurs, or is there some work to do in this way?
So I would say probably yes to both of those answers. I would say absolutely. This is a great area when you think of the companies that exist here, from the voice over IP companies to the booming successes of AirWatch to looking at some of the Cox Communications, et cetera. There are large companies here in Atlanta that play into this communication space. And then it's just, as far as the challenges go, finding a way to collaborate amongst these groups, introduce the entrepreneurs and the new ideas to these organizations so that everybody is more competitive and has the tools necessary to evolve in this market.
One of the synergies we found between Cygnus and what you're doing in Huntsville and doing here and what we're doing with the Risk Group is that you are reaching out to the CEO network in Huntsville. Mm-hmm. You have something called Quest that is somewhat similar to what we're doing with the Risk Group in Huntsville. And you have an interest in possibly creating a southeastern network, a capital network, where all the different cities around the southeast can connect with one another and together create a big capital market that can maybe rival the northeast or the west. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing in Huntsville and how you think that might be able to apply here in Atlanta.
So absolutely. In Huntsville, we have a booming entrepreneur community evolving. So there is this neat energy that's coming into fruition with some of the recent changes in government. And Huntsville, if you're not familiar with that market, has been traditionally government. We're seeing more and more interest in migrating to a commercialization play. So people are looking at how can I take this particular business concept and commercialize that, where it traditionally has been a government type of technology. So as we see that, a lot of entrepreneurs are developing. A lot of people that have been successful growing businesses, creating businesses as at the C-level are wanting to invest back into the entrepreneur community. So we are trying to bring that group into further fruition. Then our conversations with you, Trey, specifically in the Ritz Group, and looking at some of the efforts that were going on here in Atlanta aligned very well. So starting to bring those together and then continuing on conversations with Chattanooga and Nashville and other growing areas where the entrepreneur community is booming. And as you mentioned, the incentives to live in the Southeast are quite appealing. You've got the transportation here in Atlanta. You've got the low cost of living. You've got land to expand. And there are resources. There is money available. And just being able to connect those dots together is where I want to come in and play and try to come up with a good solution for this Southeast region.
Yeah, I think the connection is making the connections or being kind of an aggregator is really the key here, because it seems that if you look at any of the major cities around the Southeast, almost all of them have these entrepreneurial communities that are sprouting up, and you've got people trying to harness that energy and harness that the investment. And they're not talking to each other very well, basically. Mm-hmm. That's one of the goals, I guess, or one of the future directions you can see any of this heading, is that there has to be some sort of aggregation between all of these different cities, because all of them by themselves are maybe not, well, the exception of Atlanta. Atlanta is a huge city, but they need some help marshaling those resources. Well, thank you so much. Angie, for joining us today. We'll be touching back with you about what you mentioned it, our IGL program, our Industry Group Leader Program with the Ritz Group. We'll be touching base a little bit more on that and what your role will be in within telecom and some of the prospects here. Next, we have Kat Phillips from Kat Scratch Films. Kat Phillips is she's currently residing in Atlanta. She's a filmmaker whose works have screened to thousands in the U.S., Europe, and Asian Pacific. Her latest completed feature film, Chasing the White Dragon, has won several awards and received international distribution. Ms. Phillips has also been the recipient of multiple awards for writing, producing, and directing film, including those from Academy Award qualifying film festivals, and was a semifinalist for the Nickel Fellowship in Screenwriting administered by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Utilizing her expertise in foreign and domestic production incentives and distribution, her next film, Feral, is a PG-13 modern take on the iconic creature feature. As humorous as it is scary, the producers are currently attaching top domestic and international acting and directing talent per the desires of distributors who will offer pre-sales on the project. The anticipated release date is fall 2015. So why don't we start there? Tell us a little bit about Feral.
Okay, well, like you mentioned, Feral is a modern-day take on the iconic creature feature. So if you remember that back, I guess, in my earlier days, creature features were very popular, but the audiences, the teen audiences, the preteen audiences have changed. And so Feral has been created, drafted, written by me in order to address that new audience. We also are in negotiations with the Jim Henson Creature Shop to create our creatures. So we are, I can talk about this a little bit later, but we're, like you mentioned, we are in the process of attaching top talent. Originally in my films, I would direct the film, but this is a new world. So when a film as large as this one, it will have a named director. We'll also have named talent.
All right, excellent. So, yeah, I guess kids these days kind of want their creatures to be in romantic relationships, I guess, with the vampires and werewolves. That tends to be the way they want it. I imagine the creatures in this case are not going to be dating each other.
No. This is kind of like a very, very scary Gremlins.
Okay, all right. You know, I watched Gremlins, actually, again recently. It's pretty scary in its own right for a PG movie.
Yes.
Well, excellent. So, Kat, why don't you tell us, we touched on this a little bit, but why don't you tell us a little bit about your background in the film and entertainment industry?
Okay, well, before I get to that, I would like to mention a little bit about my previous background.
Okay.
I spent several years as a prosecutor. I was a trial attorney, and that's probably where I got my start at telling stories.
All right.
Because I had a very successful career as a prosecutor. I was very persuasive with juries. And it was because I knew how to tell a story. So when that got a little bit too dangerous to continue that career, I made a change. When I moved to California, I had newly married and was going to have a baby and moved to California. And I decided I always wanted to write a novel, so I wrote a very bad novel. It did get an agent, but it did not get sold. But I realized that, okay, I think this is something I'd like to do, so I started writing screenplays for independent films. When an opportunity arose for me to produce one of my screenplays, on a move to Pennsylvania with my husband again, I did so. And I started a company in 2004 called Kat Scratch Films. The first project was a film called Space Available. It was a short film, but it won, I don't even know how many awards it's won. It's won a lot. It was very popular, and I was very proud. We had the smart thing we did, though, was in my first film, I did exactly what Michael said. I surrounded myself with really smart people. So I had smart producers, and I had a really smart crew, and we made a really good movie. And that started my career. So I've since then made 8 films that have played all over. They did not get theatrical release, but they have played all over the world and won a lot of awards.
All right, wonderful.
So I also have a second company called Concentric Entertainment. And the reason why I interrupt is because that's the new company is important because it monopolizes on a new business paradigm that has arisen in the film industry, and which is important, and which has also led me to the Ritz Group, is that there is a change in the film industry. Most people think you can't make money in the film business, but you can. You just got to be smart about it. So we can talk about that a little bit further. But then this new company, Concentric Entertainment, is very market-driven, identified audiences, and we produce a film for that identified audience.
All right. Is that, and does Feral kind of fit into that, that
yes,
you've identified a market?
That's absolutely right. What we did was work backwards. Mm-hmm. We find out, what is the market buying? Who are they buying? What are they buying? And what are they paying for it? And so that's how Feral came about. I found out that through the distributors that I knew, international distributors, they were looking for this kind of film to fill a market niche. It's a genre film. And that's the new films that are making money. They are generally genre films. So since we knew we had distributors who wanted to buy it, all we had to do was come up with a great story that was very marketable and then start attaching the talent that they wanted to have in the film.
Yeah, whoever thought it would actually work to ask the audience what they want to watch. Well, that's wonderful. So you went from California to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
How did you end up here?
Okay. Well, once again, I was following my husband. he is a chief science officer for a local pharmaceutical research firm, and they lured him out of Philadelphia area down here to Atlanta to work in a startup down here.
All right, and Atlanta, what is it like here in Georgia? I know that you look on the TV, and it seems like every other show is either set here or filmed here. Has that nice little Georgia peach at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
What is the climate like here?
It's extraordinary for a couple of reasons, and I guess probably one of, it wouldn't really, I don't think it began with the tax credit program, but that sure has helped. And along with the sort of toughening of the economy around the world, it has drawn filmmakers, producers, and television producers to Atlanta, to Georgia, to make their films. You can make them here for lower cost, and you still have access to lots of crews and facilities, and you also have a great airport that you can fly your talent in from anywhere around the world.
Mm-hmm. And I think the crew, specifically having talent with, you know, kind of backstage talent with experience is kind of one of the things they're trying to address at the OFS plant on 85. I think the company that's buying that, I think they're trying to develop a school that would help kind of teach more, you know, so we can have gaffers here in Atlanta and we're not having to constantly fly them in from
right.
L.A.
Unfortunately, that has been the history of late, is that large productions like out of Los Angeles and whatever do fly in a lot of their key crew,
mm-hmm.
and that's not necessary because Atlanta's got great crews.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. So obviously, given your history, you bring a very unique perspective on the film and entertainment industry. What do you think makes you, what really sets you apart?
Well, I have experience and contacts all throughout the process, from writing, developing, producing, distributing, and marketing the films. And you've got to have all that now to make a movie that will make money, or at least it will pay its investment back, but hopefully make money. The way the films used to be made is people had a passion project, they wrote a script, they went out and asked their wealthy uncles or whoever to raise the money, and they made their passion projects. And there was really... most of them never had a shot at making their investment back, let alone making money. Well, I learned the hard way that's what you've got to do. You've got to know what's being bought out there and what's being paid for it.
Yeah, so that's has that all kind of come about in the last 5 years?
Yes, it has. Oh. In the last 5 years, it used to be you thought, well, what I need to do is write this movie and get a great big box office release and I make my money back. Well, it wasn't really true back then, but it's even less true now. The box office numbers, for example, for 2013 were $10.9 billion in the U.S. and Canada. The vast majority of those films were $100 million plus films. With one exception this week, most of those had that kind of type of budget. And films for anything less than that don't get a theatrical release. And so you can't count on that to help pay your investors back, and you cannot count it, most importantly, to help market your film. The second most important thing about a box office release of your film is that it fuels your ancillary sales, your DVD sales, your IVOD sales, your VOD sales. They're all sort of fueled by the box office exposure that you get. Well, if you've got a film, and say you've got $20 million in this film, and you don't get a theatrical release, then you don't get that exposure that you expected. So it makes it very tough to to find your audience. Mm-hmm. If they haven't been there in the theater and seen the trailers or done whatever, you know, or seen your film, they're not going to talk about it to their friends. They're not going to be inspired to buy the DVD or convince someone to watch it on cable, on the video on demand. So you have to come up with another way to reach your audience if your film is never going to get there. And you also have to take in consideration that now your budgets must be smaller. The advance payments by the distributors are much smaller than they used to be. And you've got to know how to take advantage of all the levels, all the different avenues of distribution for your film, not just DVD, not just theatrical.
Yeah, so it seems like film is sort of going through a similar democratization, if you want to think of it, that music went through when it became really cheap and anyone could make a really good sounding CD, and then they had the electronic channels to get it out there. Suddenly, getting picked up by a major label and becoming the next Britney Spears, which was always difficult, has now become practically impossible. But that doesn't mean that there isn't money to be made at all different types of levels.
That's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I was on the phone a couple of days ago with Redbox, and they were telling me, looking for content, and they were telling me what they were looking for and what they were paying for it. And the films that part of my company and companies that are looking at smaller budget films, you could make those films for those low budgets and get a nice return out of just Redbox alone. If you paid attention to what Redbox is buying and make the movies they want.
Like a Sharknado
Well, yes. What they want is, and all distributors want this, they want a film that they can identify who the audience is and how to get that film to that audience.
Yeah.
And that's the problem that a lot of filmmakers have. They work at it backwards. They make a movie, and then they try to figure out who it is that wants to see it. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah. I joke there, but actually my wife and I have found multiple real good films through Redbox where we're just like, oh, we'll just take a chance on it. It's only $1.29, right? Mm-hmm. And the films are great, and we've never heard of them before.
That's absolutely right.
Well, that's awesome. So let's talk about risk. Right? Risk, what you're kind of talking about in all of this is mitigating the risk for the filmmaker, for the investor, for everyone along the value chain.
That's absolutely right. That's what you have to do. I mean, money's tough out there for every industry. And if you really want someone to invest in your film, other than maybe your rich aunt who would like to see you off the street, if that's not who you're appealing to, then you've got to think about, okay, how can I get their money back? Investors are smart, and you want a smart investor. You don't want one, who doesn't know what they're investing in, because it's going to cause you problems. You want a smart investor. Well, if you've got a smart investor, then they're going to expect you to show them how you're going to make their money back before they give you the money. You need to have a plan, not like, well, I'm going to get theatrical release, or I'm going to go to Sundance and get bought by Lionsgate or something like that. That's not exactly what you have to do. You have to have a very specific plan. We've put together this film with these actors at this budget because we have pre-sales from foreign distributors who are willing to pay this much for this film. Okay, so you've got pre-sales coming in to supplement your budget. We're going to shoot this movie in Georgia because we can get 30% tax credits. If we put that peach at the end of our film, we can get 30% tax credits, and we can sell those tax credits for 88, 92 cents on the dollar. And we will repay you back with that. So you got to have a way to supplement the funding with some non-dilutive ways. And you've got to have already identified buyers, and you got to know what they're going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So that's how you can mitigate the risk.
Yeah, so that's how the filmmakers can kind of pitch their products.
Uh-huh.
What can the investors do when they're listening to a variety of products? Projects? How can they choose?
Well, if they're not experienced investors in film, they need to attach somebody who can help them identify the risk of a project. Because making money in film is not easy. So they need someone who can identify by looking at the script and looking at the business plan, is this going to make money? Mm-hmm. So they can mitigate it by being smart, by attaching someone who can answer those questions and demand that the filmmaker who's come to them with this great idea, not only does it sound great, but can they execute? And do they have the plan in place necessary to get your money back?
All right. So in many ways, the same kind of questions that investors would ask of the entrepreneur in most any other field.
That's absolutely right.
Do they have a good plan? And will the person in charge, do I believe they can carry the ball over the goal line?
That's right. Look at their team. Have they surrounded themselves with smart people? as Michael says. And like Angela says, do they already know where the market is? So, yeah. And what value do they add?
So let's talk about everything. All the T's have been crossed. All the I's have been dotted. Risk has been successfully mitigated. They've got a great plan. What kinds of returns can investors expect on film projects?
Well, the first thing is that investors need to be wise about what you really can expect. Film is really no different than any other industry. You need to expect, if you've seen all these things in place and they've given these numbers are real, and they're easy to find these numbers for the right when the project is properly set out. But they need to be. I need to realize that your return is not going to be. You're not going to be guaranteed. Even if you do get a film that does make it, you're not guaranteed. You know, 10, 20 times your investment. But you can expect, if you've done it correctly, 10 to 15%. And there was a study done in 2010 by an NYU graduate student on what does it take for an indie film to make money, for an investor to make money off indie films. And they found that if you make a slate of films, like 5 or 8 films, regardless of the budget, if you make 5 to 8 films, you can monopolize on economies of scale. And they found that on a group of 5 films, you have a 60% chance of one of those 5 films breaking out.
All right. And what are the timelines for those returns? When would an investor expect to get that money back?
Well, there's some things that are quick, and there's some things that are very slow, and most investors don't realize that. Quick would be things like tax credits, cash rebates from the government. They can be very quick. There's one state I shot in. I got a check back from the state in 3 weeks after wrapping production. So that's nice. Yeah. However, I am still receiving checks from territories on a film that was released 3 years ago. So you can expect for that money to be coming in for years. And even on video on demand, for example, it may air. You may air for 90 days one summer. You can expect not to see any money back from that, even if it did make money, for at least 3 months after that. Most distributors don't pay until the end of the quarter following when the money was received.
So who is it? Usually the distributors then who are distributing the money after the fact, or how is that money getting distributed to the different parties?
Right. Well, there are a lot of mouths to feed in the film business. So for example, iTunes will release their monies to the first level distributors after the first quarter following a quarter, but then the distributor then may not immediately who's distributing to iTunes may not immediately release that money. It may be another quarter before they release theirs. Another good thing to do is try to minimize the mouths to feed in there. For example, our company goes directly to Redbox. There is no anyone in between. Therefore, we don't have to pay any other distributors.
Okay. I'm going to kind of ask one more question, then we'll move on to our next guest. But I'm going to call you back to ask a few more questions about what you're doing with the Ritz Group.
Okay.
But everyone's talking about crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the prospects for crowdfunding for film projects?
Well, there have been some projects that have been successful in raising budgets through crowdfunding. You have to be smart about crowdfunding, too. Mm-hmm. You've got to make sure you've got enough information on your crowdfunding site that all the people who are watching it or looking at the site can get all the information they need. But you also need to drive traffic to it. People don't realize you need to drive traffic to your crowdfunding site. Now, a film budget, to make a film decent enough to get a good return on it, crowdfunding is tough. You can, however, if you use, for example, Tug, which is an interesting sort of crowdfunding source, you can get money to get a theatrical release for your film, which is a smaller number than an entire film budget.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that sounds interesting. So thank you so much for joining us today. Like I said, we'll be calling you back in just a little bit to talk about your part of the Industry Group Leader Program with the Ritz Group.
Great.
You're going to be heading up our entertainment division.
Great.
And helping with entrepreneurs and investors, marshaling the resources within that particular industry.
Yes.
So thank you so much. All right. We got one last interview here with the owner, current owner of the Ritz Group, Larry White. He is the brains behind the operation. I like to call him the if if Michael Moore is a chief rainmaker, Larry's a chief dreamer here within the Ritz Group. Thank you so much for joining us, Larry.
Trace, thank you very much. And I would like to compliment you and your team for the Business Radio X show and what that can mean for our members to showcase entrepreneurs, investors, and various projects that we have. So congratulations. Also, we'd like to thank Rick Casanova for the partnership and sharing his vision with the Ritz Group and how we can help each other. And, of course, Stone and Lee, who I've enjoyed a wonderful relationship with over the last couple of years since I bought the Ritz Group.
Yeah, we actually have Rich in the studio here. So if you hear a phantom voice, it's probably Rich. He's vowed to be quiet during this hour, but that may be difficult for him here a little bit later. So Larry, we've already talked about the Ritz Group. Why don't you tell us very briefly about your background? I've heard this story 1,000 times, but maybe our listeners haven't. So tell us a little bit about how you came to own the Ritz Group and what was the impetus behind that?
Well, the impetus behind owning the Ritz Group was I was in my business, Retail Electronic Visions, is a technology developer of social media-based community platforms. And I tried to sell a capital community-type platform, which I thought the industry really needed, to the various organizations within the city of Atlanta. And I got turned down many, many times, primarily because there was not a lot of money there to do that. All of us organizations are really not a revenue money-making business. And when I went to the Ritz Group, which I had attended as an entrepreneur, Whit Blakely had said, gee, sounds like a great idea, Larry, but we're kind of tired and I'm thinking of selling the group. And I said, I'd like to buy the group. And then I became the dog that caught the car and had an opportunity to utilize my technology for my own group. And I'm a big believer in today's world that we need to provide an electronic infrastructure that supports our physical networking meeting, that the physical networking meeting provides a wonderful forum, even better than I imagined, to create really neat things on behalf of entrepreneurs and on behalf of the community in terms of job creation and everything else. It's just it's almost like having a store in Linux as far as the credibility. And this really follows up on a comment Michael Moore made, which 10 years ago as we sat in the resource forum and talked about business clubs and how we could make an impact. And I'm pleased to say that team now has an opportunity to execute those ideas on behalf of the Ritz Group.
Yeah, well, every time I hear you tell the story about Whit, you going to Whit and him mm-hmm. basically saying, well, why don't you buy this? I always think, and I might be dating myself a little bit in the other direction, but it reminds me of that scene at the end of Empire Records where the guy has the bag of money just like, listen, I hate this place. You love it. Why don't I sell it to you? I imagine that's not exactly how it went.
Almost.
But I think of that scene every time you tell that story. So the Ritz Group, we do something different than any other organization in town. What do you think it is that's really separates us from other organizations in town? And we play ball with everybody. We're not at all jealous or trying to be proprietary about anything. We want to work with everybody, all the other organizations in town. But what really separates us?
Well, I think you just nailed the first big part, is that we recognize that it's just not one organization. From the very start, and one of the reasons that I think it became competitive in buying the Ritz Group, that Whit chose us, was the fact that we wanted to foster entrepreneurship in the state of Georgia, that we recognized that we were not the leaders, and we should be. We have 18 wonderful organizations that help groom entrepreneurs and help make funding happen in various disciplines. And it was our goal to be a powerful force in that. The first thing I did was went around and met with all 18 leaders. Well, as many of I didn't meet with all 18, but I met with as many as I could to find out how we could help them accomplish their mission. So I think that's the first thing. Second thing is technology. Third thing is we had to make our meetings extremely exciting to say this is the new Ritz Group. And then what's coming up now in our forecast for the future is to leverage our physical and our electronic infrastructure, okay, to make more neat things happen. Ritz Group Radio is one of them. Okay, we've done a lot in terms of of helping angels, and IGLs that you'll be talking about is another program that we can launch from the Ritz Group venue.
Yeah. Well, you talked about IGLs. That's a perfect segue. Thank you so much, Larry. our IGLs, it's one of the programs. We've got a variety of things that we're moving forward that we hope will be really fully formed and functioning by the end of the quarter, next quarter at the very latest. And by the end of the year, we hope to be fully running with all of these great new programs. But one of the programs we're launching first here is what we're calling our Industry Group Leader Program, or we call them IGLs. So if you hear that initialism, it's short for Industry Group Leader. And what we do is we take experts in certain industries and we put them in charge of ferrying our entrepreneurs through the Ritz Group process, through all of the varieties of programs that we have to help our entrepreneurs, as well as cultivating relationships with angels in that particular industry. One of the things that separate us is that we are generalists. We're one of the few organizations in town that are not just tech or just consumer goods. We will take any type of an entrepreneur, and that's an advantage. But in order to manage that, we need people who know these industries in order to help take those entrepreneurs, help clean them up, and get them in front of the right types of investors. You've said many times, Larry, that investors, you know, if you made your money in restaurants, you tend to invest in restaurants. So we need to make sure that we have a nice liaison within restaurants to help those companies. So two of the guests, which you've already met today, Angie and Kat, are actually two of our IGLs. Angie is going to be heading up telecom and some tech companies as she sees she's an interest in them. And then Kat will naturally be taking entertainment, specifically film and television. So let's start with you, Kat. What drew you to this program, and what do you bring to the table for our entertainment companies?
Well, like any other filmmaker, what drew me to the Ritz Group initially was because I was trying to fund films. And but I had a new business paradigm where I was working at the proposition in the correct way, finding the market first, find the buyers first, and developing a product, a film that the buyers wanted to buy and the audiences wanted to watch. So I was looking for funders, and that's what drew me there. But the more I talked with members of the group, and actually more that I dealt with other filmmakers in this area, I found that, to steal Michael's word, I found there was an awful lot of wannapreneurs in the film business. And you know what? They don't really help us. Having a lot of uneducated filmmakers who lose money on films doesn't help the industry. Mm-hmm. You can make money on films. You can make a nice, reasonable return on films, and you can even have breakout films, particularly like the one that's in the theater this week, God Is Not Dead. That's an extraordinary film to look at because it just grossed $33 million in the theater, and it's a low-budget film. But you know what it did? It did it right. It is a film with a very identifiable, reachable market. So what I would like to do is sort of educate both sides of that, educate filmmakers on making films that will get bought, that will get their investors' money back. If not as big breakouts, at least getting that nice, decent return, because it can be done. And I'd also like to educate investors so they make smart investments, because if they lose money, it hurts all filmmakers if you have a lot of investors who lose money in film.
Well, this is great for our investors and our entertainment entrepreneurs coming to the Ritz Group, because they're getting an expert who has you've done a lot of, you've cut your teeth. You know, you've done a lot of the legwork for them so they can benefit from your experience and your expertise in this.
That's right. If they would just listen, yeah. if they'll follow the plan, just like any other business, it really is. Filmmakers forget that making films now, if you want to make a second film, you better be making it like a business person. You can't just keep making passion projects because, you know, like I said before, you only have so many rich relatives. So that's what I hope to accomplish by being an IGL.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, Angie, let's talk a little bit about telecom investing. Of course, there's some similarities, I would assume, across all entrepreneurial investing. But what makes telecom different than investment maybe in other industries?
In dealing with telecom, this is an industry where the technology, if you close your eyes quickly, it'll change in that second. If you have I think of a New York minute, I think that's how quickly telecom changes. So I know that the propensity to be competitive is amongst the large companies as well as the startups and entrepreneurs. And I think capturing some of that entrepreneur flavor and identifying those companies that have the potential to be very successful and capturing their secret sauce and incorporating that into the larger companies will ultimately make those more competitive and successful and ultimately help, I think, the overall Atlanta market from that standpoint, giving back.
And sometimes telecom companies can take fairly large outlays of cash up front, correct? For something that may not have any customers yet, or they may not even have a fully working product. They can take a lot of cash up front, which, you know, is slightly different than other industries. Am I correct in that, or is that the old thinking about telecom?
No, that's still true today. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that makes investment a little bit different. So the normal thing of saying, you know, proof of concept and where are the customers, they may not be able to prove that because they're still, you know, in an alpha prototype, but they're going to need $1 million to get it, you know, to a commercial version.
Right, absolutely. Okay.
Well, that's interesting. So I'll ask you the same question that I just asked Kat. What are you bringing to the table for our entrepreneurs and for our investors that really, sets the Ritz Group apart and sets Cygnus Strategy apart, sets you apart?
So my experience lies with working with a large telecom company that was a global telecom company that serviced the major providers. So I understand that thought process and some of the methods of getting your product deployed into that particular market. And then I also bring to the table of working with a small startup that was very disruptive and very successful and now is a 10-year-old company that has been established within the telecom realm, but was a disruptive technology and saw how if you capture that energy quickly at the right time, how it can take off. So being able to know how to navigate some of the existing channels and then also being able to determine how to assign value to that idea to get it to take off and propel quickly.
Yeah. Again, you've cut your teeth in this. You can kind of help them navigate some of the common obstacles that they would face, and instead of butting their heads against a wall for years trying to figure it out, you're there as a great resource for them. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for working with Ritz Group and for joining us today. And we got Michael. You, one of the tasks that we've sort of laid at your feet here is helping us rally the angels. You can kind of be the Pied Piper for the angels. What are angels in town? What are they looking for?
Well, I think that the Ritz Group gives one of the things that angels are most often looking for. And I'll draw back to the earlier days. We used to use colored name tags to show where the targets were in the room back before we took over the group. And that tended to drive one color of name badges away because they did not want to be the targets in the room. One of the things that we have to do is prepare not only the angels, but also the new companies that are making the pitches, if you will. I mean, everybody's making a pitch for something, whether you're an angel or a new company. You've got to be respectful of the other folks. And one of the things we're trying to do is to bring the angels out of the woodwork, if you will, because they want to hide their wings. They don't want to be targets for people to be approaching all the time. Because most often the first things that the seekers of funds tell them, we talked about earlier, is the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Pitch preparation is probably the most important thing. We've all learned that by watching that movie. I think it comes on every Friday night with a bunch of rich people that invest in things. But Shark Tank, I think it's called. You know, we're not here about theatrics. We're here about the simple, true story that becomes very believable. And the fact that we know the 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 15 or even one question, it brings about the level of trust that someone's going to say, well, you know, I really would like to talk to you more about that, because it all comes back to the second meeting. Mm-hmm. There are very few marriages made on the first date. We all know that. But you've got to get the people to stay in the room and eat with each other and talk until they get to a point where they're comfortable. You know, Kat can't get a film financed on the first meeting. You know, we aren't going to see a telecom invention funded on the first meeting. You shouldn't think that your new greatest idea you've ever had as a startup is ever going to get funded on the first meeting. It's going to take a while, and you need to be prepared and prepared and prepared, and you need to present and present and present until you get to the point where the trust factor is high enough to earn an investment.
Yeah. And so what are some of the things that you know, entrepreneurs can do to make themselves more attractive and not repel the angels?
Well, one of the things Rich Group hopefully does extremely well is we begin to provide that forum, that open platform, because we have, I believe the number we use is about 2,500 people are in our community, in our network. We are a community, and we are a community of connectors, because you don't know what everybody else is doing unless you're talking to them on a regular basis. So our monthly events are strong. Our communications within the forums are strong. Our individual knowledge, everybody didn't move to Atlanta just yesterday. So many of us know each other, as Larry and I and a number of people in the room have the benefit of being in our industry for a long while. And so we've been seeing people at the 18 other groups that have been meeting for multiple years here in the city. I mean, we've got just phenomenal marketplaces for us to continue to learn about other people and continue to tell their story and continue to reinforce the facts that they're important.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Michael, for joining us today. Thank you for your years of service with the Ritz Group. And I think that you're really helping us move everything in a really good direction going forward.
Well, thank you.
So that's sort of it. We've got about 5 minutes left. We'll do a little bit of closing here with me and Larry here. Larry, why don't you tell us a little bit about what 2014 is going to bring to our Ritz Group members?
Sure. Number one, we want to do a better job of what we're doing today and what we've created with the new Ritz Group since its acquisition in 2012. Number two is electronic incubation. Okay, we want to be the regional provider of the electronic match.com connect, if you will. And that's very important with the Jobs Act today, and to make sure that we stay 506B compliant in the private equity marketplace as distinguished from publicly raising funds in 506C. So electronic communities become very important. As you've learned here today, it's very important that we gather our angels and we find out who they are. I want to spend as much time on grooming angels and finding angels as we do with entrepreneurs. That happens to be the weak spot in Georgia. In our capital community, we have over 100 angels. We have over 500 in our Ritz Group member lists. We don't know whether they're active, inactive, if they invest in film or they invest in telco, but that's really key, and we're starting to do that so that we really know what our angel demographics are all about. Last and most importantly is we, the Ritz Group, we focus on the final 20 yards, the red zone of funding. That's making funding happen. So it's very important that we get 5 companies funded that are the next AirWatch success stories for Atlanta. And that's a bold statement. We have programs to do that I think are leading edge. We call them blue chips. Last is we have to recognize, Georgia has to recognize, that we have a major funding gap in the angel funding round, which is between friends, families, and fools and VC. And if we don't fill and find ways to make that funding happen, whether it be film, telco, consumer goods, food and beverage, or the beverage capital of the world, if we fail to not help that funding gap happen, then we're going to produce 1 or 2 air watches every decade when we should be producing them 1 or 2 or 3 a year, if not a month, like Austin, Texas, and everything else. So we've started a fund and started activity to raise a fund, not only for the Ritz Group, but for the community and the other entrepreneurs, an angel fund, if you will, to address that problem.
Yeah, and we also have, at the very earliest levels, we have something called Equity U, which is going to be coursework every 2 to 3 weeks. Our very first one is actually going to be this April, April 22nd. It's a Tuesday. It's going to be running from 5 to 9. You can think of it as dinner and a course, dinner and some education. It'll come with a nice dinner, and you'll get educated on investor readiness by some of the brightest minds in Atlanta. And you can find out more about that on our website. That's www.ritzgroup.org. You can also find about all of our other programs, the IGL program, what we do for entrepreneurs and investors. Well, that's the end of our show. Thank you all for joining me. We had Kat Phillips from Kat Scratch Films. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
We had Larry White from the Ritz Group. Go figure. Thank you for joining us, Larry.
Thank you, Trace.
Angie Sandritter from Cygnus Strategy Group.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have Michael Moore, who is a chief rainmaker and storyteller in town.
Thank you, Trace.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Rich Casanova with Buckhead Business Radio X, for doing such a wonderful job at making us sound pretty. And that's it for Ritz Group Radio. Our next meeting is going to be May 1st at the City Club in Buckhead. And this is going to be dedicated to the ladies. So we'll have all female entrepreneurs and all female sharks. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful rest of the day.